Afternoon. We're going to begin the Senate and Labor Commerce Committee meeting. It's Thursday, February 13, 2014. Roll call of legislators. We have Senator Stedman, Senator Michicki, and myself, Senator Dunleavy. This gives us a quorum. I'm sure that the other two senators will be here very shortly. Once again, a reminder, please turn off your phones. So the plan today is to hold the first hearings, preliminary hearings, on SB 129, an act extending the Board of Real Estate Appraisers. And then we're going to hear a sponsor substitute for SB 80, an act relating to telemedicine. So we're going to change from the original schedule and hear SB 21 first to accommodate Senator Faircloth, who wasn't able to attend, or wasn't able to be in the room today, due to a recent addition to her family. Are you there, Senator Faircloth?
I am. Thank you, Chairman Dunleavy.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Very happy for you and your new grandchild. So with that, we're going to go to SB 21. It's a bill sponsored by Senator Faircloth. This is our first hearing on the bill.
SB what?
SB 129.
Okay. Thank you.
We have Tally Teal, staff of Senator Faircloth here. And so, Senator, could you please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony on the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. This is Senator Anna Faircloth representing East Anchorage and Eagle River. Before you today is an act extending the termination date of the Board of Certified Real Estate Appraisers and providing for an effective date. Mr. Chairman, Tally Teal is there, and she can continue on in describing the board, or if you have questions, it's fairly simple. The auditor is online if you have questions regarding the audit. The extension is for 4 years, basically because the federal government has passed some new responsibilities that the board will have to take up. And we want to make sure that we go back in and make sure that those are appropriately instituted in the board and that we have appropriate support staff for the board to do their duties.
Thank you. Do we have any questions for Senator Faircloth, sponsor of the bill, members of the committee? We're seeing no questions here, Senator. Thank you. Don Harberger, are you here from the Department of Commerce? Do we have any questions for Mr. Harberger regarding the bill? Seeing none, we have Chris Curtis. Chris, can you come forward, state your name for the record, and give us your testimony, please? Chris Curtis is with Legislative Budget and Audit.
For the record, my name is Chris Curtis, representing Division of Legislative Audit. Our agency did conduct a sunset review of the Board of Real Estate Appraisers. Purpose was to determine whether they were serving the public's interest and whether they should be extended. Overall, we conclude that the board is protecting the public's interest by effectively licensing and regulating real estate appraisers. The board monitors licensees and ensures that only qualified individuals practice. Furthermore, the board develops and adopts regulatory changes to improve the real estate appraisal profession in Alaska. The board is scheduled to terminate June 30th of 2014, and we're recommending the extension for only 4 years, as Senator Faircloth mentioned, due to the increase in federally mandated responsibilities. The audit did include two recommendations for operational improvements. However, neither of them are directed directly to the board. They're both to the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. First was directed to the division to improve administrative support to the board to include addressing delays in investigations. And the other to the DCBPL's director to improve the investigative case management system. The audit found that the investigative case management system does not fully support the investigative unit. It was purchased with the expectation that it would be an off-the-shelf system with immediate functionality as a case management tool. However, the system does not entirely meet the unit's needs. Deficiencies range from significant security reporting and conversion problems to inefficiencies in case management processing. These were caused by software limitations and a lack of procedures. The division and the board did concur with both recommendations.
Any questions for Ms. Curtis from members of the committee? I also want to let the record reflect that Senator Olson arrived at 1:35.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Good afternoon. No questions for Ms. Curtis? Okay, thank you. At this point, we'll open it up for public testimony. Do we have folks that would like to testify publicly on the SB 129? So anyone signed over there? Seeing none, we're going to leave public testimony open. Any questions from members of the committee or comments before we set this bill off to the side? We're going to hear it at a later date. Seeing none, public testimony is open, will remain open. We're going to set the bill off to the side, and at this point, we're going to turn to SB 80 substitute sponsored by Senator Dyson. We have a CS before the committee. Is there a motion so we can discuss the changes to this bill?
I have a motion, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Machicki.
Move that the committee adopt CS for SB 80 version P as the working document.
I object for purposes of discussion. From Senator Dyson's office, could we have Chuck Cobb identify yourself for the record and please give your testimony?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for hearing this bill. My name is Chuck Cobb, staff to Senator Fred Dyson. I'm here to speak to the committee substitute for sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 80, an act relating to the practice of telemedicine. The expansion of telemedicine in Alaska is exciting. I don't know if any of you got the article. I sent it to the committee. It came in this magazine. Telemedicine right now is delivered through the premier entity of the Alaska Native Tribal Health Corporation. There's 44 organizations that have delivered at over 200 sites around the state to federal entities and Alaska Natives. Essentially what this committee substitute does is it allows for other entities in Alaska to also partake in the benefits of the delivery of telehealth. It introduces into the Alaska Medical Practice Act the practice of telemedicine, which right now is not present, and it sets parameters for prescription of controlled substances without an in-person contact between physician and patient. It establishes a definition for telemedicine and provides that health care insurers may not provide or may not require in-person contact between a health care provider and a patient before payment is made for services. With Alaska's large and remote areas, the need for telemedicine is especially acute, with much of the state designated as medically underserved by the Federal Health Resources and Service Administration. So it addresses the current ongoing growth in Alaska's population, the growing need for health care, the need for increased access, and the need to reduce cost. You've already have the sponsor statement, so I won't go through more of that for you. But substitute itself, I will highlight the changes for the committee from the original version so you can kind of see how this has evolved. Section 1 adds a new section in the Medical Practice Act, which establishes the practice of telemedicine. And this was drafted by legal to be consistent with the rest of Title 8, Chapter 64, dealing with medicine and the power of the State Medical Board and the Medical Practice Act. Section 2 clarifies how prescription of drugs without a physical examination is to occur by setting three requirements. Those requirements are that the prescription drug is not to be a controlled substance, that the physician is located in the state and able to provide follow-up care to the patient, and that the person who's receiving the care send a copy of the records of the encounter to their primary care provider if the prescribing physician is not their primary care provider, and that that physician, in fact, send the records to the primary care provider. We also deleted the original license provision in the bill for an out-of-state licensing option for out-of-state physicians to practice the delivery of telemedicine in-state. That seemed to be that was after consultation with members of our state medical board and other physicians in the state. We look at this as kind of taking baby steps, building out in-state delivery of telemedicine, and we were good as the bill sponsor to not go for the out-of-state license, but to keep this all entirely within the state. Section 3 creates a definition for the practice of telemedicine by adding a new paragraph to the Medical Practice Act's definition section in 864.380. This was taken from several states that practice telemedicine. Actually, there's about 40 states that do it actively. There's 13 states that do not require an in-person contact for that physician-patient relationship to be established, but the practice of telemedicine is common around the country in various forms. Section 4 adds a new section to the state insurance code and provides that an insurance company may not require an in-person visit between a doctor and a patient before payment for services is covered. Section 5 provides for an effective date for the act. Now, in conversation with Primera Blue Cross, they brought to our attention that they would prefer that there not be a mandate to cover, which philosophically we were not opposed to, and they recommended that we state in the bill that if the insurance plan provides coverage for telemedicine, if you provide coverage for telemedicine, then that a prior in-person contact between a healthcare provider and a patient is not mandated to cover that service. So we were good with that. It basically just takes away the mandate, but just says, hey, if you do offer it, don't require that an in-person visit occur first before payment for service can be covered. And that was fine with the bill sponsor. So that is the only difference that has come to our attention from the CS before you.
Thank you. Questions from members of the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
You talked about the medical board being in favor of the legislation. Is that correct?
No, the medical board, Senator Olson, they took a position actually against the original bill that dealt with the out-of-state license, mm-hmm. and they did not want that. We removed that, and since that has been removed and to the CS before you, I do not know what their position is. I do know that the State Medical Association is neutral with this, and they have not opposed it.
And what about the Surgeons and Physicians Association?
I have not spoke with them.
Okay.
Yeah.
The other, Mr. Chairman, yes. If I could continue. You talked about that if somebody does indeed take advantage of the telemedicine issue and they go ahead and there's a not sure the word mandate was used, but there was an issue that they've got to go ahead and report it to the primary care physician. What if they don't have a primary care physician? Are they going to be in some way penalized or punished for not yeah. doing that?
That's a good question. Through the chair, Senator Olson, if there is no primary health care provider, then that requirement that those records be forwarded somewhere else wouldn't be necessary. Oh. As you know better than most, a lot of people don't have a primary care
sure.
provider.
The other thing has to do with IHS patients. How do they, realizing that a lot of the telemedicine is going to be practiced in rural Alaska, how do they participate in this important issue where it's not a fee for service, but it's yeah. certainly physicians are out there that are not even licensed in the state of Alaska that are actually seeing people in rural Alaska.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, Senator Olson, any IHS service eligible person now is eligible through the Alaska Native Tribal Health Care Center network, the Alaska Federal Health Care Access, AFCAN mm-hmm. network, now. So they participate now federally. Everything we're doing here on stateside is permissible already. So what this would do is it would expand our law to apply to anybody who is not a federal entity and is not otherwise in an eligible class such as Alaska Native, so that any person out there who is not in one of those categories could also participate now. It makes them eligible
Thank
for
you,
that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions from members of the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Machicki.
I think it's important for folks to understand that controlled substances could not be, which would have been a concern of mine, if controlled substances were allowed to be prescribed telephonically. And I'm looking for the definition. It's in 1171-140. One sec here, I'm sorry. You can come back to me if there's another question, unless the...
You need a minute?
Please.
Just a brief at ease. We'll be okay.
Mr. Chairman, I also have a subject matter expert here, too, who can...
Can we have Dr. Henry Phillips come up? state your name for the record, please, and your affiliation.
Good afternoon. Dr. Henry DePhillips. I'm the chief medical officer for a telehealth telemedicine company called Teladoc. And my company did ask me to be here today. However, I feel that my role is better served by speaking on behalf as a subject matter expert on the telemedicine industry. And any comments I make specific to my company, I'll clarify. Other than that, my comments will apply to the industry.
Thank you.
That's okay.
Thank you. Senator Machicki, did you want to follow up?
Yes, it was important to me that we're one of those states that has one of those number one demographics for some bad things. One of them is drug abuse, and some of them are controlled substance abuses. And I was just pointing out that controlled substances are not allowed to be dispensed. And I wanted to just point out, and I'll just give a quick description here. It's a substance to have the highest degree of danger or probable danger to a person or public, and perhaps you can expand on why that wouldn't be a good practice to have in a bill such as this.
Sure. So I happen to live in the state of Tennessee, which also has, unfortunately, a prescription drug abuse issue that's fairly high. So the telemedicine industry uses the standard of not allowing the prescription of any DEA-controlled substances in any of the DEA classes, which includes opiates, but also benzodiazepines, psychoactive drugs, certain psychoactive drugs, and so forth. Telemedicine, despite the fact that we sort of use existing technology, is still relatively new to the medical field, and I think most of the companies in the industry understand that the bar needs to be fairly high, and excluding DEA-controlled substances by definition, using the DEA definition is what the industry uses, both at the federal and state level, is just a real safe way to go, and that has played out very well. It's I think, helped the industry to get where it is today without incurring some of the issues that I know that you're concerned about and that we are too, quite frankly.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions?
I have a couple. Can you talk about the cross-coverage exemption and how this sort of fits into what that means and how this really isn't overstepping its bounds as opposed to what's currently occurring today?
Thank you for asking the question. So I think what really got us all in the room today is this is how I see the scenario. And forgive me, I'm not an attorney or a lobbyist or I'm a physician, so I'm new to all this. I think what got us here is the following sort of scenario. In the late 1990s, early 2000 time period, the internet prescribing scams kind of came to the forefront, and that was a problem for everybody. Most of the state medical boards, including Alaska, instituted what's called a prior in-person visit requirement in order to combat that issue. And it was very effective at the time. That was 15 years ago. And so the prior in-person visit requirement has been in place in many states, including Alaska, for quite a long time. It occurred to folks fairly quickly, if, you know, 2005-ish time frame, give or take, depending on the state, that when a physician cross-covers with another physician, so if I'm your doctor and I'm going away for the weekend and I sign out to this doctor, you're going to call this doctor with a problem over the weekend when I'm away, and that doctor is going to talk to you over the phone, make a diagnosis, and render treatment, but this doctor has never had an in-person visit with you. So technically, that's a violation of the prior in-person visit requirement, but yet it happens every week for every practicing physician who cross-covers. And so many of the boards, and I think including Alaska, have put a list of exceptions to the prior in-person visit requirement in place. So in case of an emergency situation, for example, and, of course, a cross-coverage exception. So if we agree to cross-cover one another, then the Board of Medicine said, okay, in that scenario, you can treat the patient over the phone remotely without a prior in-person visit. I think what got us to the table is a difference of interpretation of that segment of the rules. And our counsel, for better or for worse, did an evaluation on a state-by-state basis. We're regulated at the state level, the industry is, and came to the conclusion that us and many of our competitors are really a physician cross-coverage service, and therefore we would qualify under the cross-coverage exception to the prior in-person visit requirement. And that's really the way most of the telemedicine companies have operated in most of the states. At some point, it happens occasionally, the medical board, in this case, sort of gets a hold of that and intervenes with one of the physicians. And the medical board in Alaska has, in fact, intervened with one of our physicians and I know some of our fellow companies, there have been interventions and license actions taken there as well. That's a serious issue. Taking a license action changes a physician's career. It's devastating. It's reportable. Other states are advised, et cetera, and it's a challenge for docs. So we attempted to work with the medical board. This is prior to my coming to the company 10 months ago, and to try to sort of talk this out and come to a mutually agreeable position. That wasn't possible, and so we started sort of a legislative approach. Long-winded way of saying what got us here today is to say we think that the quality of the cross-coverage service in the telemedicine industry that has many controls around it, like no DEA-controlled substances, is at least equal to, if not superior to, traditional cross-coverage as I've described it here. There's now the other good thing about the industry is there's enough data. We're a 12-year-old company. Other of our competitors are a little bit younger, but several companies have been around for a while. Well over 500,000 consults, about 15 million Americans in a telemedicine program today. And the bottom line is it's safe. There have not been liability issues associated with this sort of well-boxed-in practice of remote medicine. Primary care, sponsored, not direct-to-consumer. Most of the companies like ours, your employer has to purchase the service for the employees to get it. Your health plan has to purchase the service for the members to get it. It's not direct-to-consumer. There are a couple of small companies starting to do that. There's not a lot of market demand for that. So that will happen at some point, but not today. And so the track record and the data would indicate that it's actually been safe, that patient safety and patient care has not been compromised. And the data is fairly clear. Of note, the RAND Corporation, totally independently, very well-regarded entity, did a study and published it in the journal called Health Affairs in last week. We can provide a copy if any of you don't have it, and talked about the fact that when telemedicine is available, people tend to use the emergency room for non-emergency problems less. It improves access specifically for patients who don't have an existing primary care physician, and improves access to those who do have a primary care physician but just can't get to that physician timely. So I would encourage the folks on this committee to review at least the summary of that study.
Thank you.
Long answer to your question. I apologize.
Mm-hmm. Question?
I think it's a great answer. Just one more, and I'm one of those guys that really likes having some subject matter experts serving with me. I'll be interested in the comments of the senator to my right, but in the article, and Mr. Copp, you may have read it, it talks about the difference of someone, simple ear infection that can't get treated locally, they get on the airplane and thousands of dollars later they get their $100 worth of treatment, which is probably all that's required. So can you kind of walk me through how that might work so that we know where choosing the right treatment for the right malady, if you will?
Yeah, it's a very good question. So the telemedicine industry, and there's a couple different flavors, but the flavor that's the most prevalent is common uncomplicated medical problems being cared for remotely by physicians using technology, telephone, audio, video, HIPAA secure audio, video, and basically taking care of problems that are not likely to become complex or worrisome. All of the companies in the industry, I think, do a very credible job of educating the consumers who are subject to the service of saying, look, this is for uncomplicated medical problems. If you have a more complex problem, then you need to go for an in-person visit. So the process looks like this. The request can come in. Typically, either there's a phone call to a call center or online, and you can request a consultation. And this is across all the companies that we compete with, including us. In that, you have to indicate where you're located, which helps us understand what licensing requirements are going to be in place for that request. And, of course, your age, which helps us indicate what specialty is appropriate for your request. And then the nature of the request itself. A medical history has to be filled out. Us and even all of our competitors require that at least once at the beginning of the process, revised every now and then if need be. So there is a medical record that is shared as the first part of that process. In fact, the patient does not receive access to the doc until that medical record is filled out. It's a gating mechanism. The physician, it goes out to the appropriate licensed physician. The physician then reviews the medical record, and in our platform, and I'm pretty sure the others as well, but I don't know this 100%, the physician is actually required to review the data in the medical record before they're given access to the patient for the consultation visit. There's a real-time interaction, and then all of the companies hire highly qualified physicians and then empower those docs to make the decision at the end of the day. If any of the docs, you know, based on what they're hearing and seeing, if it's a diagnosis that's well known to the patient, patient's already been worked up, it's not a complicated issue. Most docs are comfortable treating that one way or another. The meds tend to be generic. They tend to be, we don't, the industry doesn't make the pharmaceutical industry a whole lot of money. And the care goes that way. If the doc has any level of discomfort, they hear something, they see something, they sense something, that they have a concern, then all of the docs with all of the companies that we compete with are empowered to say, you know what, this is not appropriate for a remote situation. You need to see somebody in person, either an urgent care center, your own primary care physician, the emergency room, whatever the case may be. In our world, that happens approximately 4% of the time. There's no incentives one way or the other on the physician side. They get paid for rendering care regardless of what recommendations they make. So there's no incentive to refer or not refer. We don't want that to enter into the decision. So, again, a long-winded answer. I apologize.
Well, I think it's great, and it's important. And just one follow-up. I was more supportive before you told us we still had to fill out those dang forms. But anyway, Mr. Chairman, I'm finished.
Okay. Any questions from other members of the committee? Sure. Senator Olson.
Dr. Phillips, thank you very much for coming out this afternoon.
Yes, sir.
I guess I just want to know, where'd you go to medical school?
I went to Hahnemann University, which is now known as Drexel University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Sure, the high-powered school there.
I got a really good education there. I really had it was good. It was hard, but it was good.
What kind of medicine did you practice?
I'm still to this day a board-certified family physician. I practiced for 10 years before I went into industry, delivered 100 babies, made house calls, you probably already know family medicine is one of the few specialties that requires periodic recertification, and in 2014 I have to sit for the board exam yet again in April.
Okay. Where are you licensed?
I'm licensed in my home state of Tennessee.
Okay. Obviously, as we look at some of the licensure issues, you've talked about the license regulatory process that goes through and reporting to the National Data Bank and all those other nasty things that happen out there. What's your opinion related to that as far as what the medical board is objecting to, having out-of-state licensed physicians essentially practicing here in the state of Alaska, but realizing that you have to balance that in Alaska your teledoc, your telemedicine choices are actually pretty limited. Give us an opinion that you have on that, since you're kind of a person that sees it from a more global perspective.
Sure. Thank you for the question. So as far as the licensing goes, what is in this bill that our company, and I think most of the other companies in the industry, will be comfortable with, is a requirement that the physician taking the consult be licensed in Alaska, which is universal, but also resident in the state of Alaska. We're fine with that, and we think that that's the direction that telemedicine should go. So getting directly to the question, when I get in front of medical boards like Alaska and a small number of other states, there's perceived concerns. And one of the perceived concerns is that the care of the citizens of this state is going to start going through telemedicine to doctors in other states. And I get that. I understand that. And so our model, and this I'm going to speak for our company, not the industry at this point, our model is for the consult request to go out to docs who are licensed in, live in, and resident in and work in the state where the consult request comes from. It'll take us a little bit of time to get there. I think we'll be able, if this passes and gives the docs a comfort level to be able to join the program, I think we'll be able to build out a network here that's adequate so that 100% of the consults, and I'm happy to honor that the legislation. So the medical boards seem to have a concern about the care of the citizens going to docs outside of the state. Understandable. And then after that, it's really hard to understand, because the medical boards, Alaska and others, have said without that prior in-person visit, they're concerned about patient safety. And there's two data points that would argue against that. Number one is the cross-coverage situation that occurs every week already and has existed for decades, even when I was in practice. And the other data point is the north of 500,000 consults that have been done through telemedicine nationwide at this point without a bad outcome. And I would challenge any group that's done 500,000 patient in-person visits to demonstrate a track record of not even a liability claim. So I think the data would argue that that the board doesn't have that right. I think that the prior in-person visit requirement was a good idea around the year 2000, but I think that technology has come to a point where it's probably appropriate to set that aside. That's my opinion.
Can I continue, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Olson.
As you look at the requirement that's there, I'll just give an example. That yesterday I called to build a a solarium there in my place in Golovin, and the guy that I was talking to out in New York said, you know, you've got to tell me where you're at because we want to send a representative out to go and see you. First of all, I tried to explain to him, you know, I have got a Golovin does not have its own zip code. We've got to borrow the one from Nome because we're so remote. So, no, we got to send somebody out there. We know we can send somebody out there. So, you know, I said, educating the great unwash is not my strong point. And you're wasting my time and I'm wasting your time. But as you look at that kind of situation, a physician from Tennessee or Texas or New York who's out there trying to practice, who's trying to go ahead and prescribe a medication to somebody, let's say he's an elderly person by themselves, all of a sudden starts to have a problem with an anaphylactic response. He's home by himself. How do we protect that person that's the older person or the reclusive type of patient that's there that may indeed, you know, if he has an anaphylactic response, he may not survive. Good chances are pretty good that he's not going to survive.
Yeah. You know, medicine in general is not without risk. If a patient, the patient you described, sees a physician in an office, goes to the pharmacy to fill a prescription, goes home and takes the first dose, the same exact risk exists. An anaphylactic reaction can happen in that scenario as well. I think that giving the docs in the telemedicine environment the ability to say, you know what, I'm not comfortable with this happening in this setting, you need to see somebody in person, I think that's a really good backstop. I think the no DEA controlled substances is a really good backstop. I think requiring that a medical history, including a history of allergy to medications, is a really good backstop. Are there guarantees? No. I guess I don't have a better answer than that. I think that telemedicine needs to be at or above the standard of care for an in-person visit, and that's the program that at least our company, and I really would speak for my colleague companies in that regard, have out there. Most of the companies have, and we do, have clinical practice guidelines. As opposed to the traditional on-call scenario, in the telemedicine world, there's a physician peer review committee that looks at a subset of the consults that are done through the platform retrospectively to make sure that quality of care is not compromised. That doesn't happen with traditional on-call. So we've got safeguards in place that I would submit are at least as good as what's available today, but yet the access and the cost is addressed with telemedicine, I think, in a favorable way. And I think a state like Alaska can benefit more than most of the other states from the access and cost benefits.
I mean, it's nice to go ahead and have the caution out there that, you know, hey, this, I don't feel comfortable, therefore you need to go see somebody. But if somebody's on a satellite phone speaking from some cabin that's a long ways away, said we're out here hunting, and my friend over here, his eyes have rolled back and he's complaining of chest pain, he obviously doesn't have that option.
Yeah, but I think having at least telephonic or audio video access to a physician if somebody's having chest pain is better than disallowing the practice in the state and not having even telephonic access to a physician in that scenario. I still think it's a step in the right direction. Is it perfect? No. You know, Alaska's, you've got a geography challenge. You've got people spread out and, you know, you don't have physicians everywhere. But I think at least getting a physician connected other than having to physically go to the physician, I think is at least a step in the right direction if implemented well.
Senator?
And you say there's been no malpractice cases against Teladoc?
We've 12-year-old company. We provide the liability insurance for all of our docs, for all of the consults, and in the entire history of the company, hope I can say that 5 years from today, there's never been not even a claim, never mind an award, in the history of the company.
That's pretty admirable. One last question, Mr. Chairman, that has to do with, and maybe deals with the sponsor. If you're dealing with a person who has a medical issue and he's not in state waters, why have the issue of having a state-licensed physician requirement for this telemedicine, because obviously they're out there? What do you do in that case?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, that is a good question. If you are outside the boundaries of the state of Alaska, mm-hmm. that would open the door to other providers outside of this regulatory framework proposed in this statute. Yes.
So if they called somebody and they're steaming in on the Bering Sea trying to get back to Dutch Harbor and all of a sudden they hit state waters, do you anticipate that the, and this is probably not a question for you, it's for the Division of Occupational Licensing, would they be charging, or are there provisions to protect that person?
I don't know the answer. Through the chair, I don't know the answer to that question, Senator Olson, but there is a defense in public safety, and I think in most professions, a justification defense for emergency. And so I think they would do whatever was necessary under the pressure of that situation.
Additional questions for members of the committee?
That was
Senator Machuki.
It's a quick one, and that's what I wanted to clarify. I think there is a waiver for emergency treatment in most situations. Isn't that correct? I mean,
I'm not an attorney, but you've got the Good Samaritan rule, which I think exists in a lot of places, but not all. Many of the states that, yeah, you go ahead. You may know better.
Senator Olson.
Byron, I know, and let's just tell them differently. That when I was on the medical board, we did have a Good Samaritan coverage out there. But I can tell you, when I was out in a situation, my name, I had to go get an attorney after I got sued when I came across somebody when I was out flying.
Thank you. Senator Machuki.
That's good. Thank you.
Okay. You had a question, Senator Olson, that I think maybe Don can answer. So if we can bring Don Haberger up from the vision.
Do you want me to leave?
No, occupation, business, and professional licensing. Please state your name for the record. We have a question for you.
Very good, Mr. Chairman. For the record, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Don Haberger. I'm Director of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. And to the question, if I may.
Yes.
There is a regulation. The board has already promulgated. It's on the books. And basically, I'll truncate it, but prescribing, dispensing, furnishing prescription medication, and then there's other sections, but it's excluded for the use in emergency treatments. So it's in regulation. The board did address that.
Additional questions?
Yeah.
Members of the committee? Okay, thank you. So at this time, I'm going to, if there's no further questions at this moment, I'm going to remove my objection. Is there any further objection? Okay, seeing none, the committee substitute for sponsor, substitute for Senate Bill 80 is adopted. We've had testimony from Dr. Phillips. We've got none. Is there anyone online? Excuse me. We're going to open up for public testimony. Is there anyone online that would like to testify? Is there a Sheila Talman online? Okay. Ms. Talman, can you hear us?
Yes, I am online. This is Sheila Talman.
Okay. Are you planning on testifying or answering questions for the committee?
No, I was just going to be available for any questions.
And you're with Premier Blue Cross, correct?
That's right.
Okay. Any questions for Mrs. Talman? Seeing none, is there anyone in the room that would like to testify on this bill at this moment? We're going to keep public testimony open. Any additional questions from members of the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson?
I would like to get an opinion from the State Medical Board with the new on the new CS.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, we have requested that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any additional questions or comments at this time? Seeing none, we're going to set this bill aside and work with the sponsor and some fine-tuning of the language. And the schedule for next week will be posted shortly. With that, at this moment, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman.
Chuck.
We've got some good bills here. The next.